I'm going to fast forward a little bit further, but still not at the events of the play.
Welcome back, everybody. Welcome back to No Script, an unscripted conversation about theater's best scripts. I'm Jacob. That's Jackson. We're glad to have you with us as we discuss another great play, a fiery play, a family play, a political play. We're here today to discuss Other Desert Cities by John Robin Bates.
Yes, indeed. The first time I've interacted with this play was reading it for this podcast, so it's an exciting play for me still. It's a play that definitely has some kind of interesting. We've been on a little bit of it. We don't typically go on like a political run in this podcast, but like we've had a couple plays with the theme around politics in a row these last couple episodes. And it's fun to get to engage them both.
Yeah, it's interesting because like in this play, in the minutes, like politics and the storytelling of the sort of political histories, the myth making of our communities certainly was the subject of the play. And in Other Desert Cities, politics is more like the landscape of the play.
Yeah.
The context within which this sort of other story happens. And the kind of neocon conservative group that emerges right after 9/11, certain or gained more power after 9/11, certainly that group is under investigation in the play, but it's not quite like the center of the dartboard like it was
right
in the minutes.
Yeah, it's like the given circumstances, the terrain on which this story is set. So we'll definitely like have some resonances, I think, with our previous conversation from last week. But they'll be completely different too, because I think this play also has such a great family focus, such a great negotiation that's very different from the last play's negotiation. So I'm excited and grateful to have the chance to talk about it.
Yeah, we've talked on the podcast many a time about how in America, the family play as an item in a lot of ways, it is what American drama is. Not that it encapsulates everything, but that the family play has advanced American drama in the world.
Yeah.
Your Glass Menageries, your Death of a Salesman's, your those kinds of scripts that built the country up to things like Top Dog Underdog, things like August Osage County. And after The Minutes, which is definitely not a family play, it was its own kind of unique, refreshing kind of American play, we're sort of back to this play feels like the brick and mortar of the American stage.
Yeah, definitely. It has the same building blocks and the same some of the same sort of like, you know, the characters with deep love, but also so much history that there's also some anger, some even like love and hate play with each other really interestingly in family dramas. So it definitely like leans into that non-chosen family.
Yeah.
And what it means to have such long life with such folk.
Sort of like the story of the children rebelling and rejecting their parents as like kind of a central myth in America, right?
Yeah.
Like, I mean, it seems like a lot of these American family dramas, the children just like hate their parents and just like everything that they stand for.
It is, yeah. This is kind of an aside. This just, while I was reading this play, this thought jogged loose. It's interesting that in American drama, you have both this sort of a play where the narrative is children vamping or changing the expectations of the parents, but you also have like the Hatfields and the McCoys of like family generational feuding that just keeps like is full-heartedly handed down and picked up by the next generation. It's interesting to have like both of those routes taken by family drama in American storytelling.
I've also like wondered if part of it is like that American culture is very focused on like the nuclear family. So that's not sure why that emerges in our art. But I also wonder if some of it is like that America is a very young country. like compared to other places in the world, like white colonial America is very young. Like there's only been a handful of generations since the country was founded. Whereas if you're talking about other places where like there are theater powerhouses like Russia, like the UK, like Germany, France, Italy, like families in those parts of the world can go back truly thousands of years.
Yeah.
So it's, it's a different relationship with like your ancestry and your lineage.
Right, right. And it's only a couple generations back that like, you know, you were moving somewhere with just your family. So you were really forced to live with just your family.
Yeah.
I think it's definitely part of the, as you say, the kind of white colonial America version, the zeitgeist of that, that area of America and deserves and gets quite a bit of focus in storytelling as a result of it.
Well, there's your meta theory philosophy sort of discussion for today. We'll get more into the micro in other desert cities in just a minute.
Yes, but before we do, we wanted to say thank you, as we always do, to all of our patrons who are an enormous part of making this show possible. Y'all make the wheels turn on this bus. Thank you all so much for being a part of the NoScript community and helping out the show. For those of you who haven't had the chance yet or maybe haven't listened to one of our episodes, the first time hearing it and you're liking what you hear already, but we always thank our patrons and we always encourage you, if you're looking for a way to be a part of the show, patreon.com/NoScriptPodcast is a great way to do it. You can head over there. You'll find a number of different tiers of patronship, the lowest one being just $1, and a number of different other tiers that you can explore over there. But just that $1 amount helps us out a bunch. We love getting to do this show. We love getting to have these conversations, and doing a podcast isn't free. There are costs associated with hosting a podcast, with getting the scripts, etc., and the patrons at patreon.com/NoScriptPodcast make that happen. So thank you for being patrons, if you've already made that decision. And if you're looking for a way to help out the show and also just become a part of the NoScript community in another meaningful way, head on over to patreon.com/NoScriptPodcast and we will see you over there.
And now back to the script.
Here we go.
Hey, okay, so John Robin Bates, new playwright to the podcast. That means we're going to do a little bit of a playwright introduction section. If you're new to the show or you've joined recently, we haven't done one of these in a handful of episodes now. So a little bit of an extended context section today as we give you a short introduction to John. These playwright introductions are not intended to be totally inclusive. We're going to miss a lot of stuff. We're just giving you sort of an overview of who this person is. So John was born in LA and then spent a fair amount of his early childhood abroad in several different countries, South Africa, Brazil. And that's going to go on to inform a lot of what he writes for the stage. He ended up coming back to California for high school. And his time living in California, I think really you can see that come up in this play. This play has a lot to say about what it is to be Californian.
Yeah.
And I think that is comes sort of directly out of that life experience of his. He doesn't end up going to college. Instead, he works in a bookstore and from there starts to write plays that are largely based on his life experience. From his time abroad, his first play is sort of about the prep school experience in South Africa. From his time in California, he really starts to write out of his life using that as fodder to create these really interesting stories. Pretty early on, he gets an off-Broadway production starring Nathan Lane. Nathan Lane, of course, back then was not quite as well known as he is today, but still a big deal. It gets nominated for a couple of different awards, starts to get him really good press, ends up going on to have several more off-Broadway productions. That becomes kind of his niche, the thing that he's doing that's working really well are these great little character-based off-Broadway productions. Actors like Sarah Jessica Parker are in them. And then in the early 90s, he writes a play specifically for PBS to capture called Three Hotels. And that ends up going so well that he adapts it back to being for the stage. And it, again, is received really well, gets a ton of great reviews, nominated for awards. And then in 96, he premieres what he calls an autobiographical play to some degree. Now, again, a lot of these plays are based out of his lived experience somehow, but fictionalized. A Fair Country is more expressly an autobiographical script. And it gets premieres off Broadway again. We've seen that a number of times. I think even at the same place that Other Desert Cities premiered, if I recall. But this play, in 96, gets nominated and becomes a finalist for the Pulitzer Prize. Now, we've made this joke many times, including last week, but being a finalist for the Pulitzer Prize, even though you don't quote-unquote win the Pulitzer, still comes with a huge degree of honor and respect and, frankly, career opportunity. Once you make that short list, people want to do your stuff in a way that you know, they hadn't before, although clearly he had been fairly successful before that already. But lots of work starts to pour in, including what becomes a fairly well-known and lauded adaptation of Hedda Gabler that opens at the Geffen and transfers to Broadway. Now, it's not technically considered his Broadway premiere. My understanding is that it was because it was an adaptation, and so, like, technically the play is Ibsen's. But it does go on to Broadway. He ends up writing for television for a couple of shows in the early aughts, including well-known for writing for West Wing. There's a famous story about how Aaron Sorkin would just, like, put John Robin Bates's episodes, film them sort of full whole cloth without needing to edit them much, which is, speaks to the quality of his writing. He also wrote for Alias. However, famously hated writing for television. Said terrible things about the factory-like machine that is television writing, the just churn of constant stuff, a lot of it being crap that is created for this industry. He called it, he called writing for television something akin to being Sisyphus, pushing a boulder up the hill. Just not really his zone. So then in 2010, there is a staged reading of this play that we're about to discuss today. I'll get to that in just a second. He does go on. He's Bates is a Rockefeller Foundation Award winner, Drama Desk Award winner. He's a Guggenheim Fellow. All the great, well-lauded awards. Two-time Pulitzer finalist. The short list of folks that are two-time Pulitzer associated at all is not very long. So really well lauded as far as that's concerned. So, again, this play, which was originally titled Love and Mercy, that title is going to figure into the story pretty specifically when we get to the summary. First premiered at a reading in California in 2010, and then in 2011 it premieres off-Broadway at Lincoln Center Theater. I think that's the same place that Fair Country does, but don't quote me on that. Late 2011, that off-Broadway production transfers to Broadway at the Booth Theater makes its Broadway run, for which it is nominated for a wins a Drama Desk, wins a Drama League Award, nominated for an Outer Critics Circle Award, nominated for 5 different Tony Awards, and Judith Light goes on to win Best Featured Actress in a Play, that Tony Award for this production. And then it has this kind of robust regional theater life that we love to talk about on the podcast. 2012 Center Theater Group in L.A., 2013 the Goodman Theater, 2013 the Arena Stage in D.C., 2013 Denver Center Theater Company, 2013 Pioneer Theater Company in Utah, the Walnut Street Theater in Philly, and 14 Unicorn Theater in Kansas City, Capitol Rep in New York, which, by the way, the Capitol Rep production photos are stunning. Look that design up if you can. Truly, truly amazing. 2015, Portland Center Stage. 2018, the Very Little Theater in Eugene, Oregon. 2019, the Cherry Creek Theater in Denver. And much more recently, and why one of the reasons why this play has floated into our pile for the season, a little theater that I'm quite fond of, the Smokehouse Players in Arkansas. I worked with them a number of times when I lived there. Know the folks that run it. If you're listening, love ya. They produced Other Desert Cities in late 2023. Early 2024, Newport Theater Arts Center in California, the Sunset Playhouse in Wisconsin, and this month, the Chippewa Valley Theater Guild in Wisconsin is presenting Other Desert Cities. So if it depends on when this episode comes out without looking at the dates, but in April of 2024, you have access to see this play if you are in the Chippewa Valley in Wisconsin. Check it out. Other Desert Cities is there. Of course, this play is a finalist for the Pulitzer Prize in 2012. That was the year that Water by the Spoonful won, which, again, it's like, what are you going to do? Water by the Spoonful. Spoonful is like generational. So, I mean, and this play is also great. Like, all the Pulitzer nominations. Like, if you get that far, you're great.
You're golden. Yes, indeed. So I'm just going to quickly synopsize for us the plot of this play so we can jump into the conversation. I've been moving more and more as much as I can towards like flyby synopsises so we can get into the intricate moments of the script. So I'm going to do my best here, even though as I say that, I'm going to start with what came before this script. So bear with me as we go into the synopsis of the script. This play takes place in California on Christmas Eve morning of 2004. It centers around the Wyhan family, and they are made up of these folks. We've got Lyman, who's the father, Polly, who's the mother, Silda, who is Polly's sister. We have Brooke, who is the middle sister, the oldest living sister, and Trip, who is the youngest brother of the family. All of these characters are adults, they are all kind of coming together for Christmas Eve in 2004 coming to celebrate together from wherever they all are. Trip is in L.A., Brooke is out east, and the rest of the kind of older side of the family all live here in California. Now, right away, I'm going to back up in time a little bit and let you know that there was an older brother as well. There was Henry, and Henry died by suicide long ago, we are told at the beginning of the play. We know that he is long gone, that he was sort of a very important person to Brooke, a hardly known person to Trip. We find this out maybe not at the beginning of the play, but pretty early on, we discover that there was an older brother. And that this older brother had some like different political leanings to the family, because the Lyman and Polly especially are kind of this like Reagan era conservative old watch folk, the kind of old guard of the Republican Party from the Reagan era. And they, in addition to being kind of from the acting and movie making world, Lyman was an actor and Polly was a writer. They kind of made the switch into politics, and Lyman became an ambassador during the Reagan administration, and they kind of hobnob with the conservative elite. We know that Henry, the older brother, didn't share these political views, that he was kind of a part of the hippie movement, that he protested the war in Vietnam, and that he was not the one directly responsible for an act of violence, a blowing up of a veteran center or an enlistment center during the war in Vietnam, but he hung out with people who were, and so he bore some sort of like tangential responsibility to it. And he died as a result of that guilt. He took his own life. I'm going to fast forward a little bit further, but still not at the events of the play. Brooke is a writer. Brooke has kind of had written a successful novel a while back, and then has taken like something like 6 or 7 years off of that of her writing. And in those years, she has kind of had a bit of a rough run of years. She's kind of gone through the process of going through rehab. She had a depressive episode. They were all kind of worried about her well-being enough to the point that they were concerned that she might take her own life. And so Brooke has been on a journey these last couple years as well, as she is trying to write a second book, get through that sort of mental health space that she was in. The whole family was as well. The whole family went out east and helped her during that year. And so that's in the water. All of that is in the water as we pick up Christmas Eve morning of 2004. The family is meeting together. They're celebrating the morning. They're also kind of celebrating the fact that Brooke has finally put out a new book. And they're not really sure what it is yet. She hasn't told them what it is yet. But in amidst all of their prepping for the party, it's becoming known that she's very close on it, that she's going to go make copies of the book. She didn't bring enough copies of the book with her so that she can share it around with people. And she does, as they're out Christmas shopping on Christmas Eve, they return and she has made copies of the book, kind of to the surprise of everyone. They were kind of assuming that they wouldn't get it for a while. And we start to see some of the cracks beginning to form. The family is very flippant with each other, makes fun of each other often. But we start to see a little bit more of Polly noting that Brooke is kind of withholding this book from her. The other character that we're introduced to during this time is Silda, who is Polly's sister again. And Silda is recovering from having fallen off the wagon. She is an alcoholic and very recently fell off the wagon and is in recovery at their house. And so all of these characters are in this melting pot together here for Christmas Eve. And into that melting pot is thrown the memoir that Brooke has written. And Brooke has chosen as the subject matter of her memoir the life of her brother Henry, which is a kind of a shock to everyone because she focuses on what really happened and what her perspective was. A lot of what Silda's perspective was, which is that her parents, Lyman and Polly, kind of drove Henry towards this moment in his life that he kind of rebelled against their politics and wanted to take a stand against it. And when he came to them for help after the bombing, they turned him away, sicked the police on him and turned him away. And then he assumedly died somewhere. No one has ever found him, but they just know that he is gone. So this lights a fire underneath all of the family. Polly reads through the book, and especially Polly reacts pretty strongly to it because it is revealing in a way that she is concerned about in their relationship with the other politicians in their life. Lyman tries to keep the peace for as long as he can, but eventually he is hurt by it as well because turns out that they're holding secrets as well. And slowly, 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 we see more of those secrets coming to light. All the while, we have Brooke heartbroken that her family can't support her in this, even though she's telling a hard story. She wants to tell a true story. So she's dealing with her family's anger at her for that. We have Tripp trying to kind of triangulate and play the middle person about a brother that he didn't know and parents that he loves and a sister that he wants to support. All of that in the middle of it. We have Silda dealing with her mental health and her substance abuse and how she's interacting with all of it. It comes out that she helped Brooke write a lot of it. All of this builds and builds and builds. Finally, at the very end, the kind of pressure cooker of this book is coming out very soon in the next couple months. Also, I'm publishing an excerpt of it in The New Yorker, so in a couple months, they'll be part of it out. This pressure cooker leads Lyman and Polly to admit the fact that they helped Henry more than anyone knew, that they managed to cover up Henry's life, that he came to them months after the event that Brooke explains in the book in her memoir, that he got in the car with his mom and she took him north to Canada and he kind of jumped the border in Canada and he can't contact anyone. They know that he's alive. They know that he calls every once in a while, doesn't say anything on the line, but they know that he's alive. And this is a revelation to Brooke. She knows nothing about this. And all the while her parents are kind of pleading with her just to wait until they die, till they've moved on to publish this stuff and they can publish whatever they want after that. And she thought it was because of these political connections that they had, but it turns out that they're protecting the life of Henry, who is in exile essentially in Canada, because if he ever were to be found,
I mean, wherever he is, now he can't come back to America.
Yeah, yep. And so they're trying to protect him from people who would still want to bring him in for his role in this explosion. She all the time, all the while, through the course of the play, she has been saying, I have to publish this. It's my truth. I'm going to publish it, even if you don't want me to. And that's kind of the end of the 2004 segment, is the parents revealing that Henry's alive and she doesn't have the whole story. Please just wait to publish it. And the last couple pages of the script are 6 years later, 2010. She's doing a reading of her memoir, which is Love and Mercy, a memoir. And there's some more events in it. She's kind of published it. She's reading it, doing a reading in Seattle. And it also includes, we don't know all of how much of the story of Henry she tells. We assume that there's some of it in there. But we do know that she tells a little bit of the story of her dad passing, of Lyman passing. She tells a little bit of the story of her mom as well, the last couple years of her life as she decided to move in with her mom or move next door to her mom and spend more time with her. It ends with this kind of like plea of hers in somewhat guarded terms, obfuscation-y terms of her wanting to find Henry, saying something along the lines of, I don't know how I'm going to find him. I'll just read the last line. How will I find him is her last line as she talks about her book. It's talking about Henry. So that's the fast version, the flyover of other desert cities.
Yeah, I mean, so at its core is this conflict between within the family about whether or not, Brooke ought to publish this memoir, which revisits this hard time in the family's life and paints the parents in a fairly negative light. And the different family members, the parents, the sister of the parents, so Brooke's aunt and her brother, they all have different different perspectives on that, and they're sort of different shades of it, right? The aunt is in full support. This is the best book ever. Definitely publish it. The brother thinks she should publish it, but doesn't think that everything that's in it is true. Her parents sort of look at it like, I think you've really fictionalized the events. You don't really know what happened. You feel you're angry towards us, and so you've written this book that's not, you know, totally accurate. But really, at the core of it is this question of like, should I, can I, there's a practical question, there's a moral question, there's a familial question of like, do I have the right to publish this hard story where I paint my parents as the sort of perpetrators of this terrible thing that happened? And a lot of that conflict, that questioning, that digging really comes out of Bates' own curiosity. There's a great interview where, and I, as I was telling my context section, I tried to set this up by describing how many of his plays come from his life experience. A lot of them do, including one that he's even described as being fairly autobiographical. And so John Robert Bates has had this question for himself as a writer. This is what he says in this interview. "It reached a point where I wondered about the hubris in the act of writing about people who are actually living beings in some way. And I thought so many people do this and so few people get to respond to it, really. There are so many great memoirs and they're also absolutely unreliable in the fundamental sense. I think I was having a kind of low-level crisis of consciousness." I don't know about you, Jackson. I mean, I've read a lot of memoirs. I like memoirs. Our undergraduate institution kind of pushed memoirs on us as reading material. And this has been a question of mine about memoirs for a long time. I've often thought, like, if I were going to write some sort of memoir about my life, like, I don't think I could.
Yeah.
Not that I couldn't actually sit down and write it out, but like the idea of airing the, you know, not that my family has like a ton of dirty laundry or anything, but like airing this sort of private secret life of being a family and having those sort of private intimate moments, because those are what make memoirs great. Seeing
right.
into these hard situations, these private conversations, this sort of voyeurism of that. And at the same time, I've always felt when reading memoirs, like, how does your family feel about this conversation that they thought when you were 13 they were having in private
right.
is now in a nationally best-selling book?
Yeah, no, it is a wild thing, memoirs, to kind of have that weird, like, kind of like telling secrets about your family that are kind of behind closed doors most of the time.
Do we assume secrecy, you know?
Right.
And like, what is your obligation to keep private conversations? Like, if you know someone who's an artist or a writer, should you just like never talk to them?
Right.
Because it might be in a book.
Right. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, it could be in a book. You also have the weirdness of you know, you're approaching a book, you're approaching a memoir of any kind, whether that's a book or a play. In a moment, I'll say something about memoirs in play form. But you approach either of those with this kind of like mode of authority for the author. You show up to this, you know, couple hundred pages, and you're like, well, I'm going to at least assume that I'm going to trust something about this author and that this is an accurate portrayal, at least in their estimation of what happened. And I think this play does a really interesting job of just like talking about memoir as a really interesting thought exercise and like a debate around the efficacy of memoir happens in this play, but also addresses subjectivity of memoir. And in a big way, I mean, the move at the end to have such a big secret kept from us that completely reorients the way we've engaged this debate, the whole play, is a big move. And it is honestly a little jarring in the reading of it to be like, oh, I understood nothing about what was happening this whole time. But for the first, like, you know, 5/6 of the play, there's this really compelling debate about does Brooke have the authority just because she is a writer, and she says over and over, I'm sorry, I'm a writer, but I am a writer and I have a prerogative to write this thing. It is what I've landed on. I have the prerogative and the authority to write it because it's from my experience and it's from my subjective perspective, and I will be sharing it. And the really complicatedness of writing about living people in a manner that they will be known, and especially in the way that she's writing in, like, the almost like a historical memoir of, like, these people are not obfuscated in any way, obfuscated is the wrong word. It's obvious that the people she's writing about are her parents. And so there's no way for them to dodge it, no way for someone to say, well, she's just kind of using this as a pseudonym or something like that. It's their story too. So who owns the story is a kind of core debate through this play.
No, absolutely. And I think that that's a... I find that to be a really genuinely intriguing question for a play.
Yeah.
I mean, when we talk about writing plays, because plays are sort of necessarily a short form thing, right? They're like 2 to 3 hours is sort of a long play. So, like, right. Plays are necessarily a short form writing thing. Like, presenting interesting characters with an interesting problem is, to me, the best shortcut into playwriting. And I think that this play is that beautifully done. I mean, I think that is a genuinely interesting problem. There's this real painful thing that, and there's people who think different things about that thing all over the family. And do you have the right as a writer to publish, to write, to air those secrets to the world? But then I love that John Robin Bates makes it more complicated than that. I mean, this is what the best playwrights do. They take an interesting problem, an interesting group of people, and then they add a bunch of other interesting layers to it. There's the layers of the fact that number of people in the family have been lying. There's the interesting fact that, like, a poorer version of this play, Brooke is like a crusader, and the book is a perfect account of what happened, and her parents really are the villains. And everybody agrees this is exact, but there is this additional layer of, like, this isn't even necessarily, like, the right thing in terms of how it happened. I mean, even her younger brother says that, like, I don't recognize the people that you've written about here. Those yeah. are not how my parents really are or really were. And her parents reveal a number of different things about what, like, went on, including the big secret at the end, but a number of sort of smaller things that Brooke didn't know. It's revealed that the aunt who helped Brooke in the writing of it held back a major piece of that story because she didn't want her dirty laundry aired in the book. Like, the book itself, in a poorer version of the play, it could have been this perfect golden thing. And in this version of the play, it's made more complicated by the fact that it's, like, real in the sense that it is necessarily not perfect. It is subjective. It is flawed. It is, it's not going to be like the textbook account. It's going to be this one person's sort of biased account of it.
Yeah. Yeah. It is kind of like, it's, I agree that it'd be completely different if she was a crusader, because there's this sort of, like, It's weird for a character like Brooke, who is so unapologetic in her stance most of the time,
yeah,
to kind of have this, like, small bead of apology in there of, like, honestly, you guys, you're not coming off all that bad. Yeah, it's a little revealing, but it's just my experience. And it's I get that it'll be hard, but it's not going to be catastrophic. And the use of that miscommunication or that missed connection is really sussed out so well in this play, because she kind of has this motive. I'm sorry, but I'm going to do it. And for Polly, and eventually for Lyman too, who tries to ride that train for as long as he can to try to be supportive to Brooke. But once he discovers to the extent to which it's going to reveal what we know below the surface, is reveal stuff about Henry that shouldn't be revealed yet, but we think it's to reveal his political connections with people. He also has this position of, this is catastrophic. This is not only catastrophic in terms of what it's revealing, it's a straight up lie. All of it is a lie. And Polly has a number of these lines that are consistently like, these people come off as crazy villains in this book. This is like a fictionalized horror novel that you've written or something like that.
Well, and I think that like it's a normal, or it could have been a normal like tactic for the character parents in this play to say, this is fiction, this didn't really happen. Like, that I could see happening. What I think John Robin Bates does so well in the play is that I think the audience, based on some of the other characters who give their perspective of the novel, are led to, I don't think we're led to believe, oh, Brooke wrote this perfect account.
Right.
I think we're led into this, like, well, because it's just Brooke's account, should she have, you know, what is the right thing to do with that account of this painful story? And what do you do with the fact that it cannot be anything but a subjective account of how Brooke experienced this thing, which was that she experienced her parents totally abandon her brother, which then led to his suicide. And so I just think that, like, I feel conflicted about the novel, and like, I'm a, you know, anti-censorship, writers have to write, right. Art should make you uncomfortable champion. But the play is written well enough and gray enough and murky enough and messed up enough that even I'm like, boy, that would be really hard. Maybe some of that's my own personal, like, I've thought this about memoirs for a long time. Like, boy, that's tough.
Yeah, I agree with what you said earlier, too. Like, the thought about writing a memoir, especially about people who are alive, like, intimidates me. I'd be much more comfortable writing a play that is a memoir, because play deals in a lot more metaphor. It deals in a lot more showing rather than telling. And interestingly, that's pretty much a line in this play. Tripp has a line that's like, when I told you to write a memoir about this, I thought you were going to, like, write a play that no one would ever go see. So there is that, like, that move towards, or the desire towards, and I mean, I'm sure it says something culturally about the two of us that we're both uncomfortable with memoir, but it is this sort of like move to, like, you know, we keep some things hidden, right? And Brooke kind of moves more in this space of, no, I have an obligation to tell this story, both from my, as a way to find some sort of justice for Henry, but also by virtue of her position as a writer.
No, absolutely. Early in the play, there's a great line from Lyman, which I thought was a nice observation. And again, sort of John Robin Bates doing a good job bringing these things that we question in our lives to the forefront of the conversation. He says, a lot of people get through the entirety of their lives pretending. At a certain point, it's not the worst thing to do. Now, at that point in the play, what we believe he's talking about, and maybe even what he actually is explicitly talking about, is just sort of like going along to get along. Like, this was such a painful event in their lives that it's not something that they talk about. That's brought up a number of times. I mean, just in terms of like sheer writing craft, the audience knows well before we even really know what's in the novel that the subject of Henry is something this family doesn't talk about because it's shameful and painful and dark and hurts and all that. And so then when we put the pieces together, oh, and this is what the book is about? We already right. know what a big deal that is. I mean, just to celebrate what I would call the writing fundamentals of setting up that story along the way. But I like that point from Lyman that part of what playwrights can do so well is like really voice the things that we really think sometimes, right? Like, there's this sort of anti-pretend vibe in society, right? Like, you shouldn't pretend, you shouldn't do that. But I think Lyman says, like, sometimes that's just what you have to do in life, is like, it's not the worst thing. There might be other worse options. And regardless of how you feel about that, that's a genuine viewpoint that people really hold and that this character brings into this world where let's just not talk about it. Let's just not, we're through it. It was years ago. Let's not rehash this. Let's not get it on the news again. Let's not, and it's again amplified, just to go back to what I was saying earlier about how John Robin Bates makes this problem more complicated. We're also not dealing with characters who are just everyday folks, right? Who are just, you know, teachers and garbage men and grocery store managers and bankers and just regular folks. That would be hard enough. Like, my family's all regular folks. If I published a memoir airing all of the terrible things that have happened in our lot, like, it'd be hard enough for us regular folks. But
right.
The Lyman and Polly are politicians. They're famous figures in Californian Republican politics. Lyman was an ambassador at one point. They know the Reagans. They know the Bushes, it's strongly implied, although the Bushes are not named. These are like real national players. Lyman was a movie star before he went on to be a politician, which of course is like just using the Reagan story and then saying that he's also friends with Reagan, which is funny. But I mean, again, to add an additional layer of complexity, it's not just going to be painful. There's like real reputational stakes here.
Yeah, well, and especially like let's especially before we find out the fact that Henry is likely alive somewhere and they're protecting him. The right. Kind of the main core question is that like there's stakes for this information getting out, stakes for the relationships of the people who came over to dinner, all that business. But then the flip side of it is, well, but you were public figures, and there is sort of like a justice question in this too, of like. Yeah, it's, I mean, normally you would want justice to come about if someone, like, pushed their child to this point, but certainly of an elected official for whom family values is something that they espouse, there is this sort of, like, but really, like, you should be held accountable, and if all of you all are kind of, like, on this scale of public influence, I'm speaking pseudo from Brooke's perspective, yeah. You should, the story at least should be told.
But again, I think this is John Robin Bates making this story more complicated, because that would be easy to do. If all Brooke wanted to do was publish the memoir, that's easy. She's actually got a publisher. It's going to the New Yorker in a couple months. That's not what she wants in this play. She can, the novel is going to be published. The memoir is going to be published. It's got a publisher. It's going into the New Yorker. What does she really want? She wants her family's permission. She wants them to continue to love her. She wants to continue to be friends. She wants to be part of the family. She wants to maintain the close connections. I mean, this is a family that's close enough that when she was experiencing this deep period of depression, the family flies out to the East Coast and stays with her, pays for her to stay in an expensive hospital as she's recovering. Not that that's not something other families wouldn't do, but I just mean, like, this is not like an estranged family.
Right.
This family is close. They care about each other. Brooke wants that to be maintained. And to publish this memoir in which she publicly punishes them for what she perceives as her treatment of Henry. You can't have it both ways. And so again, this playwright takes a really interesting problem and adds layer and layer and layer of complexity. All the easy answers are pulled out, right? Because it would be easy to do that if you just didn't care about the relationship.
Right.
But he takes that easy out away. He takes the easy out of, well, nobody's going to care if the local grocery store manager mistreated his son 25 years ago. Well, you know, it takes that away. No, this is a famous person, a truly famous person. Takes away this memoir is perfect and it's justifiable to send it out. Takes that away. Oh, nope, the memoir is not perfect. So in some ways, adding complexity is about taking away easy solutions to the problem.
And if that wasn't enough complication, you also have like a motive question asked too, because we discover that Silda actually has given a chunk of the experience to Brooke, or at least Brooke has corroborated her experience
with
Silda.
Silda's
the aunt. And so she's there, and she also has this like contentious relationship with Polly, this very close relationship with Lyman. It's not like heavily insinuated anything, but they're all very close. And so you have like there's all sorts of this connection points there too, the underlying motives of all the characters, how much of this, you know, is Silda kind of having a voice in there. There's a point where Tripp says, I know Mom/Polly is going to hear Silda's voice in your writing, and what's gonna happen. And she does. And so there's all that in there too, of like who's like supplying what, giving what information for for what reason, whose voice is what at what given moment. It's so delightfully complex.
No, absolutely. And it there's also, I think, the other interesting question that is presented in terms of like a moral or reflection on society and family. I found it to be a sort of really interesting thing that Polly and Lyman were considering across the course of the play, which is this question of like, how long does a parent, how long is a parent expected to just go along blindly supporting the things that their children do? At one point, there's this term indentured servitude thrown around, and both Brooke and Polly use it as an argument for their side. Brooke says, well, what? Just because I'm your child, I'm not allowed to do these things? Like, I'm an adult. How long am I going to treat me like I'm an indentured servant? And Polly says back, well, what? Just because I'm your parent, I'm expected to just be cool with something that's going to be incredibly painful, incredibly embarrassing, is going to, you know, really significantly impact these last couple years of my life. And I thought that was another interesting sort of layer to this question of like, what are our real obligations to like sort of put up with our family? Because the people that you're close to are going to do things that hurt you and embarrass you. It happens, you know, and the good ones will apologize and make reparations and things like that. But it's just part of living. But in this relationship between parents and children, is it necessary that as a parent, you're an endlessly giving well?
Right. Yeah. Just kind of endlessly like being okay with whatever your child does / like picking them up again, et cetera.
And of course, at that point in the play, we think she's talking about mostly her relationship with Brooke in this book. I think once you know the end of the play, you can also apply that to the fact that they know that Henry is out there and helped him escape the country. And literally for that point forward in their lives are accessories to a crime. And,
yep.
You know, Lyman describes how they basically have to pretend to be these like sort of patriotic, regular, good old GOP neocon folks, even while they know they helped someone who bombed a military enrollment center flee the country.
Right. And you have the kind of flip question held down well with Brooke. Certainly, Brooke doesn't share their politics necessarily, and has the wondering around, like, it's like, I'll still love you, but like, yeah, you say some things sometimes that are hard to deal with. But also Tripp has the other like hold down of that line of thought too. Tripp has this like, they are so close. Like, they're 20 minutes away from me. Every time they come to Los Angeles, I have to like take care of them. I'm the one helping them like figure out their emails and their smartphones. And the sort of it's asked around the table, essentially. What is the line? Is there a line ever to cross for us?
Well,
you also have the question
Polly
between
and Lyman basically say, like, if you do this, this is the kind of thing that breaks our relationship.
Yeah.
And I mean, there are things that break relationships, and something that playwrights and maybe all storytellers do is try to find what those things are for the relationships that make up their story and give them to their characters. What could Brooke do to ruin this relationship with her parents? This is one of the things.
Yeah, find the breaking point. And you have it there with Polly and Silda too. Interestingly, you kind of, I don't know, this might just be my interpretation, my experience of it, but you kind of see between Polly and Silda a relationship that is past that point in some way. There was a breaking point at some point.
Well,
and there
see,
is,
that's interesting. I'm not sure about that because Silda is still living with them and like under their care. It's actually, everybody sort of universally agrees, although I don't think Polly ever actually says it out loud, that because Silda helped Brooke with the memoir, Silda is going to be, like, now the relationship is going to be broken. And so it sort of comes down to maybe the same thing that is going to be the breaking point.
I do like that as the confluence point for sure. I think there are little clues to let us know that that Polly and Silda haven't been, like, it's not Polly who's insisted that Silda stays with them.
Sure, that's true.
It's Lyman. And just the way that they, like, throw barbs at each other constantly. Like the
Although
way that
the whole family does that.
All the time. But Silda's come with, like, you are an insufferable person and no one likes you.
Yeah.
So there's just a little bit of that wondering around, like, That's certainly in Polly's mind, too, as she's grappling with Henry, she's grappling with Brooke, and she's grappling with her sister, all in this kind of, like, it's the holidays, right? So these are always the times when things go bad. And so this, like, pressure cooker of an evening where all of it collides, this question of how long can we hold the line on this family is asked.
Yeah. Well, I am actually fascinated by how the play ends. We don't have a lot more time to talk about it, but it seems to be implied from the last scene that Brooke actually does move back to California and is around for the large majority of the end of her parents' life. And she is, at the beginning of the play, they're all sort of negotiating the fact that she lives on the East Coast and she hates California. She's refusing to move back. And so somehow, as a result of the play, she ends up deciding to move back. I don't have any reason to think this that is in the text. So this is pure speculation. I don't know how much of that is true. I have a really hard time believing that after learning that this lie that she's been told, that her brother killed himself, and she has believed that since she was a child, and she describes, 5-10 times throughout the play, that it was like this single event that, like, ruined a large part of her life, that she, like, he was the person she was closest in the world to. She was, it absolutely devastated her to lose her brother in that way. It's strongly implied that it's part of what caused her depression. And so to learn that it was fake and that her parents have kept this secret for so long, it's just, you described in the synopsis, I thought adequately, that it's a little bit of a shock to read this secret reveal because it's a little bit of a convenient secret. I'm not actually totally sure why they don't come out with it earlier. It doesn't seem that devastating of a secret to reveal to me. I mean, to reveal it to the world would be, but Brooke's not going to tell anybody. So,
right.
But what helps me understand that is if I think this is the thing that they could do that would ruin her relationship with them, is reveal that they've lied about this for years.
Interesting, yeah.
But I want to acknowledge that we don't actually get that in the story that she tells in her book during this book signing event that is the last scene, is that her parents lovingly passed away and she was there and Lyman, he argued with the director because of the dementia in his last moments and Polly finally passed and they grew really close after the men died. There's something about a line in there. And I don't know. Maybe the story is that she learned that her parents had truly been protecting Henry all along, which is the thing that she wanted, and that justifies this sort of sharp turn. But that's hard for me to imagine that doesn't. I mean, in terms of things that break trust, I mean, she
right.
is explicit about what a devastating thing this was for her in her life. She describes it as if she says it felt like I had died myself.
Yeah. Yep. Yeah, it's a wild jump, and it's like, you know, five years and 3 months or whatever, March 2010 from Christmas
also,
Eve.
At the beginning of the play, they're playing mixed doubles, like tennis. And then 6 years later, they both, like, pass naturally of old age. The timeline there doesn't quite mess up to me.
You do miss out on, like, just a ton of what, you know, must have been the processing of it. And I agree, especially with our conversation about memoir earlier, there is this note of, like, well, are you really remembering, like, telling us what actually happened? Or is this, like, your
what gets
presentation
included in the memoir?
Of it?
Does she write about the fact that Henry's still out there?
Right. We don't know.
I don't know exactly. I'm actually so much more interested in the next 5 years after the revelation in 2004 than I am in the book signing in 2010.
For sure,
like,
yeah.
That's not, to me, a very interesting scene. Like, the what happens after? What happens to a family after the parents reveal that the suicide of their eldest son was a fake?
Yep.
Like, what does that do to your family? I have no idea. That's fascinating to me.
Mm-hmm. Yep. I think the one piece, as far as that last scene goes, that gives me a little bit of credence, availability to entertain that it could all be true, is that Trip is there. Yeah. And that's the little piece of, like, well, we know, I mean, and maybe they both had a similar experience and are in the same place, but we know that family is still there. We know the family didn't, like, fall completely apart. Trip is around and he's at least hearing it. We know Trip speaks his mind. And so he's at least willing to sit in a reading of the thing and hear it read out. So you have that little bit of information, but it's a small little kernel, and there's so much unsaid in that last scene, so much to leave you curious. And I think that's somewhat the purview of this play, is there's so much. And the purview of memoir, there's so much to make you curious, to wish that you could, like, pull back the drapes one more time.
There's a great line when she finally reveals, she tells everybody, okay, listen, I know I said it was a novel, but it's actually a memoir, and it's about our lives. And somebody says, I forget which of the other ones says, well, what's in it? And Polly very astutely says, the question really is what's not in it, isn't it? And that, to me, is this play. The question is, like, and that's, like, that's the question of the memoir that she actually writes. Like, what's not in the memoir that she's signing books for in 2010 in Seattle?
Yep. We are sadly near the at the end of our time.
Very much at, if my timer is correct.
The end of our time for this particular episode, but great, great play. Jacob, read off the places that are doing it in the near times, if you are listening to this podcast near its publishing date. So I hope you have a chance to go see it. If not, please have a chance to read it. Audition for it if you are able to. And when you do, when you interact with this play in any way, we'd love to continue the conversation with you. You can find us on Facebook, Instagram, or X at the username at NoScriptPodcast. We also have a Gmail, NoScriptPodcast@gmail.com. Find us on any of those places, and we'd love to keep talking about other desert cities with you.
Absolutely. If you enjoyed this conversation, any of the other conversations from our now nearly full 12 seasons, please recommend us to your family, your friends, anybody you know that likes stories about, or conversations rather, about stories, about writing, about themes and characters and all that great stuff, like theater. Send them our way. They can find us on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, Spotify, YouTube, all the places where you get your podcasts. We publish a new episode every Monday, and it should appear on Facebook for an easy click and play for those less tech savvy folks in your life. They got a Facebook, they can listen to the episodes. Until next week,
I'm Jackson, and that's Jacob. Thanks for listening to No Script, the podcast.